Coming up, it's a 10th anniversary special.
Let's listen to some highlights from 10 years of philosophy talk.
I do think there are cold, hard, objective facts about what might be.
Lori Paul on What Might Have Been.
If I had never gone in to the coffee shop that morning, I would never have met my future husband.
Michelle Elam on biracial identities.
A lot of mixed race people do struggle with the fact that they may not visually register to certain people as of color, but that doesn't mean that they haven't had experiences themselves or with family members or friends where they see discriminatory practices.
Cecile Farr on regulating bodies.
Think about military conscription. To say you have to fight in that war is to say, well, we, the community, have a claim on your body.
Celebrating 10 years of philosophy on the radio. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're in San Francisco, coming to you from the studios of KALW.
Continuing conversations that begin on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
But we spent part of the past decade right here with you, doing philosophy on the radio. And we thought it would be fun, a lot of fun, to take a look back at some of the highlights of the past 10 years.
10 years of philosophical radio, over 300 episodes. That's amazing, Ken.
Yeah, it's been so long, John. I can hardly remember where this all got started.
Well, let me take you back. It was really before you got involved. I used to listen to Car Talk, and then I used to listen to something called Money Talk, and probably several other things called Talk. And they talked about boring things like cars and money. And I thought, how about talking about something interesting like philosophy? Why can't there be a philosophy talk? So I took this idea to my friend David Israel, and he said it was the stupidest idea he'd ever heard. So I just shut up about it. And then you came along, and I said to you, how about philosophy talk on the radio? And you were enthusiastic. You actually went out, got some money from Stanford. We made a pilot. We found Ben Manila, who was a really good producer, and that's how we got started.
You know, it turns out that it actually takes a village, as a great woman once said, to make a radio show like this work.
Well, maybe not a whole village, but definitely a few good producers, researchers, and roving reporters.
The roving philosophical reporter. Now, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's about where the rubber meets the road, that moment of truth when the abstract arguments come to an end and you're confronted with concrete choices.
Well, let's listen and see if we can actually hear the rubber meeting the road. As our roving philosophical reporters file these reports.
If you look closely, you can see the prisoner's dilemma playing out in our lives every day. In business partnerships, romantic relationships, and spectacularly in game shows.
This is serious, life-changing money. Your jackpot today is £100,150.
There's a British game show that's no longer on the air called Golden Balls. Players compete to win a pool of money, then in the final round, with only two contestants left, each has to decide.
Split or steal.
There's a Hollywood version of Falling in Love.
I've loved you ever since the first second I saw you.
Man waits all his life for a woman like that.
I'll love you for the rest of my life.
And then there's real life.
There always seems to be something that's wrong with the person.
Alicia is 36 and lives in San Francisco. She's been dating since she was 15.
Every person is sort of like, oh, this drives me nuts, or I don't feel at ease as I should. I think there's a lot of shoulds in dating.
Think about something a really long time from now. No, longer than that. I'm talking your grandchildren's grandchildren's grandchildren are long dead. That's the kind of time frame Alexander Rose and the Long Now Foundation are trying to get people to think about.
A 12-hour dial that you see in most clocks is not very relevant for our type of clock.
They're building a millennium clock designed to last 10,000 years. That's as long as human civilization has existed.
When I walk down the street, I'm a black person. I'm not a biracial person.
Anissa Tanksley is a 16-year-old student at Brannan High School in San Jose, California. She says she's always had trouble finding her place in the world because of her biracial identity.
My mother is Irish and my father is African American. My parents were divorced when I was younger, and I'm not in connection with my father at this point.
What are thoughts, and where do they come from?
Gosh, that's a tough one.
To find out, I asked people in downtown San Francisco.
Basically, I guess it's what we process, what we see, smell, you know, our senses. So whatever we sense is just how we process it, and I think that's where thoughts come from.
Oh, I don't have an answer. I have to think.
You have to think about what thought is?
Yeah.
These days, Eric lives in Sebring, Florida with his wife and two kids. He works in construction. He says he finds himself imagining what could have been if he'd taken steroids like so many of his teammates and added some speed to his fastball.
You know, if I did, who knows? Maybe I blow out my elbow sooner. Or maybe I do go and play 4 or 5 years in the big leagues and have that, you know, that cushion of financial security that I wish I had now.
But for better or for worse, Eric feels he made the right decision. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks to Caitlin and to all who roved before her. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, my fellow Stanford philosopher.
Today we're celebrating 10 years of doing philosophy on the radio. Now, John, let me ask you, what would you say it actually means to do philosophy?
Well, that's something that modern philosophers like to say, but it also goes back to the most ancient of philosophers, Socrates and his pals. Their idea of philosophy was dialogue, conversation. Obviously, that wasn't all there was to it, because both Plato and Aristotle were voluminous writers. The point was they both focused on philosophy as an activity as opposed to a product or a body of results. Lots of times when you're at a cocktail party or you meet somebody, you know, and you say you're a philosopher, they say, well, whom do you teach or who do you teach? The idea that, well, philosophy is just this body of work by dead guys like Plato and Aristotle and Kant and Hume. And if you're a philosopher, you must teach that. And so we like to emphasize, no, philosophy is an ongoing activity.
Right. It's a kind of thinking. It's a kind of thinking about, you know, you take an idea or you take a belief. And you ask, well, what justifies me in having this belief? Why do I have this belief? Should I have this belief? And you say, well, here are some reasons why I should believe this. Or here are some reasons why I don't believe this. I shouldn't believe this. And then you weigh the reasons pro and con. And it's that weighing the reasons pro and con that is, you know, characteristic of one characteristic of philosophy. It's not just that. You think there are ways that the world is. Like in certain times, women were subordinate to men. Blacks were subordinate to whites. That's the way the world is. Philosophy takes the way the world is and asks, should the world be that way? And then it tries to imagine other ways the world could be. And then it tries to imagine, well, how might we get from the way the world is to the way the world ought to be? That's philosophizing. And, you know, most interesting philosophical questions, there are at least two sides to them. There's at least a yes, it should be this way, and there's a no, and there's no, it shouldn't be this way, or yes, it is this way, or no, it isn't that way. And there are powerful considerations on each side. And again, part of the activity of philosophizing is trying to decide what weight goes with what consideration, pro or con. So that's a lot of what we do on the air. You know, we ask our guests, we always tell our guests, why should we give weight to that? Why shouldn't it be this way? What about this? Have you thought about this? And that makes Philosophy Talk different from a lot of radio, a lot of reporting. I mean, we're not reporters. We're not your typical hosts, because your typical hosts ask questions and let the guests answer them as often as not. The guest turns around and asks us a question, challenges something we say, because we're doing philosophy with our guest and with our audience. And when you're doing philosophy, nobody really has a privileged position, right? We're all on equal footing, arguing back and forth, giving reasons pro and con. I say, these are the reasons pro. You say, no, those aren't good reasons. I say, yes, they are. And you say, right, so that's what we do.
Well, you know, most Americans engage in something that's really part of philosophy, which is politics. I mean, or at least the better part of politics. And politics, in the sense that you're trying to convince someone to vote for someone and discuss, you know, it's rational discussion. And nobody thinks that we're going to reach a solution and, you know, it's going to be like a physics problem that eventually somebody will do an experiment. And, oh, now we know that, you know, conservatism is a bad idea and liberalism is a good idea. It's just we got to work things out. So there's a certain amount of tail chasing, but on the other hand, there is a real sense of progress in philosophy, at least I think there is. For example, you went back to St. Augustine's time, I mean, read his Confessions. One thing he thinks philosophically about is why do the stars form patterns in the sky? You know, it seems amazing that it's not there to provide some meaning. On the other hand, you know, there are reasons that he had even back then to see that, well, no, it really... that's really not so obvious and so forth. But he didn't have any way to approach it, really, except philosophically. And then a little bit empirically, because some of the theories of the meanings the stars provided turned out not to be true. Now, you know, that's settled. That's not part of philosophy anymore. That's part of scientific knowledge, that the patterns that the stars make from the point of view of Earth have no meaning for human behavior and weren't put there for a purpose. So you don't call that part of philosophy anymore. You don't call, you know, physics part of philosophy anymore. So, yeah, philosophy gets the leftovers. And so one thing about leftovers is they're leftover. Once they're settled, they're not leftovers anymore. They're part right. of knowledge.
We don't philosophize about settled things, right? I mean, there's no point in philosophizing about settled things. But there is this. Some of the things that we take to be settled don't deserve to be settled.
That's true.
And so there's always that's why our slogan is we question everything except your intelligence. We question things that some people might take to be settled. Some people take it to be settled that gays ought not to have the right to marry. Right? There were times when people took it to be settled that, I don't know, kings had a divine right to rule. Well, yeah, so you took that to be settled, but is it really settled? And so one of the things that we do is we try to bring to bear this, you might call it an adolescent attitude, this adolescent attitude of, like, who says, right? Who are you to say that I have to go to bed now? Well, who are you to say that this is settled? Because I'm going to unsettle it. I'm going to unsettle it.
Our colleague Michael Bratman once says, well, philosophy comes down to two questions. What do you mean, and how do you know? And you just kind of keep pushing them, and pretty soon you'll be a famous philosopher. I may be embellishing a little on what he said.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. For 10 years and counting, we've been questioning everything except your intelligence.
We don't question your intelligence because we rely on your intelligence. And we also rely on your sense of wonder. As Aristotle noted long ago, it is owing to their wonder that people now begin and at first began to philosophize. We've wondered about all sorts of things together over the past 10 years, and in our next segment, we'll revisit some of them.
Some of our favorite objects of wonder when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're celebrating 10 years of doing philosophy on the radio.
Ken, we've produced more than 300 programs over the past decade. We've talked about everything from the meaning of life to preemptive military strikes to baseball.
Now, you know, people might think that there's not much to philosophize here about baseball, John, but, you know, they'd be wrong. Baseball is an amazing thing, and one thing amazing thing about it is that each moment is pregnant with possibilities.
That's one of the things that makes baseball so unique. 2 minutes to go in a basketball game, and one team is up by a huge margin, the game is over. You know nothing will happen to dramatically change the score, because nothing could happen to dramatically change the score. But in baseball, Giants up 10 runs, ninth inning, they still could lose. A comeback is always possible.
Yeah, that actually raises a deep question, John. What exactly are we saying when we say that something that didn't happen, nonetheless, might have happened?
Well, we put that question to Lori Paul from UNC Chapel Hill in one of our all-time favorite episodes, What Might Have Been.
I think it's really important to think clearly about what might have been. And I think it's important to think clearly, even just for personal reasons. For example, if I want to think carefully about the kind of person I want to become, or the kinds of things that I want to make happen in the world, who I should vote for, how to learn from my mistakes. So, for example, if I do something and something happens as a result of that, I might think back and say, well, what could I have done differently? And what would have been the result if I had acted differently? And that's the way I learn from my mistake.
Well, now, a lot of people might think that, well, yeah, we do engage in such reasoning, but this is all, if not quite fantasy and fiction, it's all just the imagination. It's unconstrained by the facts. Do you agree, or do you think there are really some facts, cold, hard, objective facts about what might be, must be, and can't be?
I do think there are cold, hard, objective facts about what might be, what might have happened. And that's why I'm so interested in trying to figure out partly what those might be and partly how we're supposed to try to discover them.
But the thing that John said in the opening, it makes that intriguing. I mean, the facts about, you know, my being a philosopher, I know what sort of constitutes those facts. You know, I say, yeah, he went to graduate school at Chicago, he got a degree, he got hired, he writes philosophy articles. Those are concrete things that I actually do, concrete properties that I actually have. But, you know, I think Quine was worried about these facts because he couldn't figure out how they could fit into the world. I mean, how can facts about what might be fit into the world, which is, you know, a totality of actual things?
Well, here's one way that I like to think about what might have been. You start with some rules, which I think of as kind of regularities or rules about what happens, like in a game. And then you consider different possible scenes or scenarios or different possible initial conditions. And that's where you have to do a little bit of imagining, because you have to think about, well, there's what actually happened, and then there's the imagined thing that I could plug in instead and then apply the rules, the actual rules, to see what you get out of that.
Well, let me give you an example, or let's just take our example. So Ken could have been a lawyer. I say, well, Ken obviously could have been a lawyer. He had the LSATs in his hand, and he decided to rip them up and not take the exam. If he decided differently, he would have gone to law school. He's a talented, intelligent guy. If he'd gone to law school, he would have become a lawyer. Clearly, Ken could have gone to law school. But somebody else might say, no, Ken clearly couldn't have gone to law school. Somebody who's so interested in philosophy as he was and so taken up with it, there's no possibility, even if he'd taken the LSATs, at some point along the line, he would have opted for philosophy. So we got two seemingly good arguments. How do we know which the fact, the cold, hard, objective fact about the possibility of Ken going to law school, which side does it come down on?
Okay, so this is why sometimes philosophy is interesting, because things get tricky. And what the metaphysician, like me, is going to say is, well, maybe both of those are right. It just depends on which rules you're taking to govern what you're going to get once you stick your input conditions in. So you're each picking out different actual rules or regularities and then reasoning to different conclusions.
This seems true. I could have become a lawyer. And there's something else that seems true. If I had become a lawyer, I might have been had more money than I have now, but I wouldn't have been happier than I am now. So I want to just focus for a minute on what exactly are we saying when we say something like that? Tell me what a statement like that just means.
Okay, so I like the lawyer example. I'm going to focus on a different example, how I met my husband. And let's just say I met my husband when I went into the local coffee house, ordered a giant coffee, and, you know, our eyes locked over the barista counter.
Oh, this sounds so romantic. Right?
So romantic, yes.
Well, and was this Starbucks or Pete's or Seattle's
Pete's.
Best?
It was Pete's, yes.
Okay, but what?
And we realized that we had a commitment over the coffee. Now, if I had never gone in to the coffee shop that morning, I would never have met my future husband. And I think that's a safe assumption to make. I think there's a fact about that. And what I'm keeping fixed is that, well, what I'm assuming is that I would have sort of gone straight and would never have gone to the coffee house, and that I never would have met him in any other way. So yeah, there's a kind of regularity there.
Yeah, my son, though, my teenage son, he sometimes gets fascinated by counterfactual thinking, and he says, yeah, you know, the problem is that if you change one thing, like I didn't go into the coffee shop, a lot of other things might change too. And he also says, very perceptively, well, to get you not to go into the coffee shop, a lot of other things that lead up to it have to change. So how do you know what's going to change if you don't go into the coffee shop? And how do you know what you have to change in order to get you not to go into the coffee shop? And isn't it just sort of like, you know what I mean? So are there answers to my 15-year-old son?
I guess I want to say that there's something right about what your son is saying, which is that there are a lot of different ways to think about what could have happened. But just because there's a whole bunch of different answers we can come up with doesn't mean there aren't a whole bunch of different clear, careful ways we can come up with those answers.
Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps.
Lori Paul from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, helping Ken and I think about the world as it might have been. This is Philosophy Talk, and it's our 10th anniversary special. We're listening back to some of our favorite episodes.
And one of our favorites was an episode we did recently on unconditional love.
You know, I really like that program because, like a lot of our programs, our guest was a scientist. And it's interesting to see how philosophy and science can mesh. They don't always, but sometimes they do. In this episode, you and I made a lot of distinctions, or I should say I was very skeptical about unconditional love, and that forced you to make a lot of good distinctions. But then when our scientist came on, Lynn Underwood, she picked right up on the complexity of the philosophical aspects and showed how those fit into the research she'd been doing about unconditional love.
I entered into the whole idea of science of love as an epidemiologist because I was really fascinated with measurement. I've been measuring things all my life, and I like measuring soft things in people, like social support and stress and things that are really hard to measure. And I've developed a measure called the Daily Spiritual Experience Scale that was looking at the transcendent features of life, how people interact with the transcendent. And one aspect of that, four of the 16 questions on that scale were about unconditional love, it to others.
Let me ask you then about unconditional love and exactly what you mean by it. I mean, it sounds like it involves a great deal of blindness. Don't people want to be loved for who they are and what they are and how lovable they are instead of being loved blindly and unconditionally? Or what exactly is your definition of unconditional love?
Well, it's a kind of a selfless caring for others, a love centered on the good of the other, sort of loving people through thick and thin, the whole idea of self-giving, other-centered love, one that is designed to enable the other person to flourish in whatever way they can. So, and it's centered on the good of the other rather than on ourselves.
What role do I play in this? And does myself play? Am I supposed to just negate myself? Am I equal to the other in this unconditional love? I mean, totally unself-regarding?
Yeah, well, when I developed this, it was I was trying to think about a balance system. So when I did research to kind of look into this, I thought about the whole idea that we have to have a balanced attitude to love. We have to balance giving and receiving. We have to balance care for self and care for the other. The you were mentioned earlier in the program, the issue of a battered wife. And I think those sorts of situations somewhere, the person needs to value themselves and put the safety mask on themselves so that they can help others. And I think we need to balance a kind of a care for self with this kind of self-giving love for others.
Lynn, of course, we're philosophers. We don't want to get bogged down in facts. You know, we just like to argue. But you've done a lot of empirical work on this. So what's the most surprising thing you found about unconditional love in your testing and surveying and measuring?
Well, there are a couple of things that I might highlight. One was a study that Ben Carney did on married newlyweds. He studied newlyweds at the beginning of their relationship and then looked at how it predicted longevity of the marriage. And the thing that was most predictive of longevity was everybody, of course, when they were newlyweds, or most of them anyway, were in love with the other person. But some of them really were very aware of the failings of their spouse early on. And it was kind of the combination of this you know, abiding generous love for the other person and thinking they were wonderful, combined with an awareness of their failings that predicted the longevity in those newlyweds, of their marriage for those newlyweds.
It seems to me plausible. Lots of people have argued that parental love is a form of selfless love, but you might even wonder there because the child is connected to the parents in a certain way. So it's love for a person connected to yourself in a certain way. Romantic love between marriage partners, you might think of it as selfless, but there's a kind of reciprocity there. And without the reciprocity, it's hard to see how a marriage could be sustained. So, I mean, are those really forms? I mean, would you really call either of those things selfless? Because, you know, in the one case, we have a reciprocal relation, and in the other case, we have our own offspring. I mean, if we loved other people's children as much as we love our own, that might be selfless, but... Do you know what I mean?
Right, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, there have been studies of adoption. I mean, why do people adopt children from different groups, for example? And that kind of brings out this notion that we can care for those that are different from ourselves or not our children. And I think, too, there's cost in parenting, even though they're your own children. There have been some brain imaging studies that look at kind of mothers imagining, you know, looking at faces of their own babies. And, of course, areas of their brain lights up and it's all positive, typically. But there also have been studies that have looked at the mother imagining getting up in the middle of the night, being really tired, the baby crying. And there, in those situations, the two areas of the brain lit up. One, the more affiliative area, the kind of one that lit up when they looked at their baby's picture. But also there was kind of an amoral area of the brain, moral engagement, that lit up as well. So this sort of challenge of anybody who's had maybe a teenage child, you know, you're stretching beyond the sort of natural affiliation that might happen when you have a smiling baby. And I think those kinds of things that encourage the social affiliation with others could be thought of as an evolutionary drive toward altruistic behavior toward others, a kind of a cooperation in a situation in a group.
Lynn Underwood from Cleveland State University, showing how philosophical concepts have informed research on unconditional love.
This is Philosophy Talk. It's our 10th anniversary, and we're celebrating by revisiting some of our favorite moments.
Well, you know, Ken, a lot of our programs have to do with making abstract problems vivid. But we also love programs that challenge common sense assumptions that we might otherwise never have thought twice about.
So, John, I'm going to test your common sense. Here's a question for you. Who owns your body?
Well, at one time, I would have certainly said me.
That's right. And that's, I think, what most people would say. It's obvious, right? It's so obvious that you own your body. But we had a guest on an episode called Regulating Bodies. Our guest was Cecile Farb from Oxford University. And she argued, get this, that you do not own, at least you do not own exclusively, your own body. I went into this episode thinking, oh, come on. You have got to be kidding me. And I do remember we pushed her really hard. But in the end, she gave a pretty convincing case that, in fact, you do not fully own your own body.
Suppose, you know, you walk down the street and there is a puddle of water and a baby is drowning in that puddle of water. The only way to save the life of the baby is to lift the baby out of the puddle. You're the only person who can do it. Now, do you think you are morally obliged to do that?
Well, I think it would be a darn callous thing not to do it, and I think I should do it. Maybe I am morally obliged, but why does that show the baby? That doesn't show that the baby owns my body, does it?
No, it shows that the baby has a claim that you use your arm in a particular way at that particular point in order to save his life. So if you believe that, then you don't believe that you own your body fully.
So let's be clear here. So you said, to say that somebody owns my body in your parts of my body, in your vocabulary, is really to say they have a claim on the use of my body. Not
yes.
Just I have a claim on the use of my
That's
body.
That's right. That's right.
Well, isn't that a funny sense of ownership? I mean, somebody might have a claim to use my car, you know, because suppose it's the only way that we can get somebody to the hospital and all that. They have a temporary claim on the use of my car, but that doesn't mean they own my car. After they use it to get this person to the hospital, it goes back to
yes.
me. It's rightful and sole owner.
So I agree. The same with your arm. Once the baby is rescued, you know, you regain a claim to the use of your arm. So that it's in that one sense that you don't fully own your arm. You can't do with your arm whatever you want at any time.
So in a way, though, you're saying the ownership of our body is like the ownership of other things, at least in most states. It has limits. I mean, the U.S. Constitution protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures, but it doesn't protect us from reasonable seizures. And
absolutely,
our car can be seized for emergencies.
Absolutely. Yes,
and so
absolutely,
in the same way, our body could be seized for emergencies.
In that way. Or think about military conscription. You know, to say you have to fight, you know, in that war is to say, well, we, the community, have a claim on your person, on your body, to fight in that war.
Okay, Cecile,
yes,
it's clear that you believe that a person can actually have the right to expect or demand part of somebody else's body or somebody else's bodily services. Where would such a right come from?
Well, I think we have a right in general, within certain limits, to receive help when we need it, you know, particularly as a matter of life and death. So the welfare state, which is funded through taxation, is one way in which we as a society honor this right. And I just think that, you know, it can be, the argument can be extended, you know, again within limits, to parts of the body.
Okay, the welfare state. It redistributes wealth. It takes some from money from some, spends it for the general
That's
good.
Right.
It sometimes
That's
even
right.
transfers money from X to Y, right?
That's right.
But money is not like intimately connected with my person and my being. Money, you know, I can have an excess of money that's far more than necessary for my flourishing, you know? But arms, legs, eyes,
so,
is different.
So arms, legs, eyes, I agree, are different. But I mean, I have an excess of blood. I don't need all the blood that there is in my body now to continue to function. I don't need all the bone marrow that I have to continue to function. I don't need all the liver cells that I have in order to continue to function. So what's the difference with money?
Well, I mean, that's a rhetorical question.
No, I think she means that as a real question.
It's a real question. It's not rhetorical. It's a real question.
You mean the analogy with taxation quite seriously. I'm not even sure you mean it as an analogy. I mean, the argument that supports tax schemes, you think that very argument supports, as it were, redistribution of excess bodily parts. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's because I simply don't see what is different in a morally relevant way, between money on the one hand and the parts of, you know, our body, such as blood and so on the other hand. But I also think, to be even more controversial, that after death, we simply do not own our body. So after death, I must make my kidneys available, my liver, my heart, my lungs, my corneas, and so on and so forth.
So I just want to draw an analogy between your view and what I understand to be Ayn Rand's view.
Right.
Because you both see this strong analogy between our ownership of our own body and our ownership of the wealth that we come by. But where you do a modus ponens, she does a modus tollens.
Explain what that is.
You say just as our wealth really belongs partly to the state and is for the use of others, so is our body. And she, to oversimplify, no doubt, is what is a subtle body of work, says, just as nobody has a right to my body or any of my bodily parts, they don't have a right to my wealth and the things I accumulate.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So I agree with her that, you know, they are analogous, but I do very firmly believe in taxation. I'm not prepared to give up on that. So my view is, given that I do believe, you know, in taxation, then I have to accept limited rights over the body.
Cecile Farb from Oxford University, arguing that our bodies are not wholly our own. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary by combing the archives for great philosophy on the radio.
We've had some terrific guests join us over the past decade, Ken. But you know, there's one guest you and I especially look forward to hearing from on every program. And that, dear listeners, is you.
The listener speaks when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're revisiting some of our favorite moments, celebrating 10 years of doing philosophy on the radio.
Our next clip is from our show on biracial identities, and it exemplifies a lot of things I really like about Philosophy Talk. Of course, we had a great guest, Michelle Elam. We were able to talk, I think, quite casually and frankly about something that some people find upsetting to talk about, whether, you know, Obama is a white man like me or a black man like you or something new and important in between. And we had listeners call in. We had a lot of good calls who took all kinds of positions on this, often very heartfelt. And finally, we had great music because who doesn't like to hear Cher singing Half-Breed?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mary Jane. What's your comment or question?
Well, I am from a mixed-race parents, and my parents were born in 1929. When they were married, their parents wanted to put them in insane asylums because they couldn't. They were in such a shock. And when we went out any place, everybody would stare at us as if we were part of a circus because we, as a family, mixed-race family, were stared at constantly. I remember in the 1950 census, I was asked to pick a color. They asked me what color my mother was, and I just never thought of my mother as being a color or a race. Mm-hmm. It was only my mother. And when it came to me, they asked me what color I was, and I said, I refused to pick one or the other. And it was that when I realized that society would try to make you into one race or another. When the war came along, I was beat up all the time because I was Japanese in Pennsylvania. And then I went to Japan, and I realized I wasn't Japanese. I was American. Mm. So the emphasis should be on cultural identity, I think, and more discussion should be on that.
Okay, thanks for the comment, Mary Jane. Michelle, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a really moving account, actually. And one of the things that it reminds us of is that historically, being mixed race was often made you the subject of derision, of legal penalties. Of course, until the Loving decision in 1967, it was illegal in many states to intermarry. And so one of the things that's curious is that now in the contemporary moment, you have this glamorousness associated with mixed race, even though the actual stories of people suggest that still there's discrimination. And so that's one of the things that's fascinating for me, which is how is it that you can have this popularization of mixed race at the same point that does absolutely overcome some historical discriminations, and yet we still have racial inequity in this country.
That's an important point. I want to go back a second to a question I asked for an explanation, and you gave me one, but I still want to press it a little bit. I think there's a deep reason why mixed race people are not free to identify with the socially unmarked race, mm-hmm. right? Because the marked race is often oppressed. Right. An act of identification with them is an act of solidarity.
Absolutely.
And an act of disidentification with them is an act of, well,
racial apostasy. Sure.
Some kind of betrayal, some kind of separation. And because we're invested, because the unmarked folks are invested in maintaining their privilege, mm-hmm. and the marked folks mm-hmm. are invested in overcoming mm-hmm. their oppression, those two sets of people have some kind of stake in the identification of these
folks. I think that's spot on. I think you're absolutely right.
We've got a ton of callers. We've seemed to have tensed a nerve here. Beth in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Beth.
Hi, thank you. This sort of goes against what the last caller said. I look completely white, mm-hmm. but I am mixed race. Mm-hmm. Both my parents appeared white, but my grandmother was what was referred to at the time as mulatto. Mm-hmm. I'm 46 years old, and I remember in the 60s, when I would go out with my grandmother, she often was treated very poorly. And when I would say to people, don't treat my grandmother that way, they would say, oh, this isn't your grandmother. It's just your housekeeper or your nanny or something, which was very offensive. So, but I was never treated that way. I got to see it because there was my grandmother, but I had blonde hair. My brother had blonde hair. There were two little blonde-haired white kids walking around for all those people cared. So I think a lot of our identity is formed by people's perception, or visual perception of us. However, I did have cousins in South Carolina that referred to my brother and I by using the N-word.
Beth, thank you for the interesting story. You got any clicks going
on? I think it's a great comment, and it's a useful one, because a lot of mixed-race people do struggle with the fact that they may not visually register to certain people as of color. But that doesn't mean that they haven't had experiences themselves or with family members or friends where they see discriminatory practices. And that, I think, is very useful for mixed race people to think about both light skin privilege, because the fact that you perhaps didn't experience the same discrimination but were bearing witness to it means that you do understand the way your particular position as a mixed race person is continuous with civil rights and social justice issues.
Tim in Alameda, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay,
so
what's
having
your...
this kind of a Schrodinger's cat experience here.
Okay.
I've got these two philosophers in a yellow box in my kitchen, and after looking, well, I never knew which one of you was, I didn't figure either one of you was black, but then I saw your website, and I figured one of you was, but I didn't know which one, so I figured, well, it's probably the guy with the lower voice. But now today I found out it was the other way around.
Uh-huh. Okay, well...
So if I got two philosophers in a yellow box in my living room, is either one of them actually any race at all?
Well, yeah, I'm black and John's white. Is there a deep point behind this question? I mean, are you wondering about the reality of racial categories?
I think he's making a deep point. I mean, the idea is the cat either, I don't know, gets chopped in half or not, depending on some quantum thing, but it doesn't really happen until the observer looks. And maybe race is like that. I don't know if it's a quantum phenomenon, but it's really very much in the idea of the observer. There's kind of a collapse of racial identities when you get out in the crowd.
There you go. Race only exists when beheld.
But actually, that's not always true. It's really interesting, especially with some mixed race people, not all, is that race isn't always writ clearly on the body. And that was what a lot of the early legislation in the 19th century was about. It's how, what do you do if you cannot see and legislate black people? Black people, and I think that goes to your earlier thing. What happens when it's not clear if somebody's black or white? And some of that changes over time, like a lot of the early NAACP, Walter White and Diane Nash, other people who were civil rights activists, were blonde and blue-eyed but identified as black. But the often, if you're trying to legislate race, people feel very uncomfortable with racial ambiguity if they can't tell what you are. And so actually, and in this case, the caller couldn't tell what you were by some presupposition about what a black person sounded like,
right,
I guess.
Right.
Michelle Elam from Stanford University, along with a host of callers who joined our conversation on biracial identities. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're celebrating 10 years on the air.
John, we've talked about our favorite topics and good guests, but there's a guest that no matter what the topic, I always look forward to. That's Allison Gopnik. Now, Allison is by trade a psychologist, a developmental psychologist. He studies babies, but she studies them in such a philosophically lively and interesting way. I mean, she's interested in the big philosophical questions, and she's trying to answer these big philosophical questions by the methods of psychology and studying, in particular, babies. I mean, it's really cool. And if you listen to her, you can just be mesmerized by the breadth and depth of her knowledge of all these different fields in cognitive science, psychology, philosophy, computer science, artificial intelligence. They all just run together smoothly in her really powerful brain.
You're surely right about Allison. She's great. Our most recent program with her was recorded live at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. Let's listen as she tells us a bit about what we can all learn from the minds of babies.
One of the deepest questions in philosophy has always been, how can we find out the truth about the world? After all that comes to us from the world are photons hitting the back of our retina and little disturbances of air at our ears, and yet all of us live in a world of chairs and tables and people and quarks and photons and distant planets. How do we ever get, and we think that's true, how do we ever get there from here? Well, what we've started to discover, really, just even in the past 10 years, is that babies have extremely powerful learning mechanisms, very powerful capacities for things like probabilistic induction, the sort of things that philosophers of science have talked about, very sophisticated scientists doing. Now, babies do all this unconsciously, not consciously, but they can use some of the same kinds of techniques for looking at patterns of probability in the world and inferring the way the world works that we see in science and we see in very sophisticated machine learning. Let me give you a practical example. Well, maybe an impractical example. This is work that my colleague Fei Xu at Berkeley has done. So what she did was she showed babies a box full of ping pong balls. This is the classic philosophical urn. In philosophy, it's always an urn. So she showed them an urn full of ping pong balls, 80% white, 20% red. And then, this was with nine-month-old babies, she showed them an experimenter who either took four white and one red ball out of the box or took four red and one white ball out of the box. Now, if the baby's thinking like a philosopher, then she should think that that second sequence, four red and one white, although it's possible, is very improbable given the statistical nature of the urn. And sure enough, that's exactly what nine-month-olds thought. Nine-month-olds looked much longer at the possible but improbable event than at the more likely one.
Right.
So these tiny babies already implicitly were using principles about randomness, about selection, the kinds of things that we would use if we were very sophisticated.
You have another
scientists.
Book called The Scientist in the Crib. And I mean, I think this is a deeply important point, because go back to what we said about language and how rapidly and effortlessly kids seem to acquire language. That convinced people like Chomsky that it was already all in there and there wasn't really much of a learning problem, because if it were a learning problem, given the meager data they had to work on, it would be impossible.
Exactly.
He thought statistical regularities couldn't possibly do it. But this new kind of work you're talking about, I think it's really eye-opening. It's deeply eye-opening, because it gives you – you don't have to be a full-bore Chomsky nativist, and you don't have to be a naive empiricist.
Right.
The baby's minds are really complicated learning machines.
Exactly. So I think we're getting to a place which isn't just a sort of, you know, wishy-washy compromise between nativism and empiricism. What we're actually starting to say is, here's what babies start out knowing, here's the learning mechanisms that they're born with, and the amazing thing is that you put those two things together and you can learn the incredible range of things that human beings can learn.
So let's go to a somewhat different realm, morality. Mm-hmm. My favorite philosopher, David Hume, says there's an inborn benevolence in human beings. It's not terribly strong. It can be easily destroyed, but in the right thing, it can be nurtured. Do you find that there's an inborn benevolence in babies and toddlers?
Well, not only do we find that that's true, but actually Hume, who is also my favorite philosopher, I think got it right in an even deeper sense. Because what Hume said, and he was sort of alone among moral philosophers in saying this, was that the origin of that benevolence came in our emotions, in our feelings, not just in what we think. And when we look at even very young babies, we see that even young babies are already empathic. They already can recognize and take on the feelings of others. And by the time they're 15 months old, they're not only empathic, but altruistic.
So you've got some nice experiments about this that illustrate this.
That's right. So this is an experiment that actually was done by Felix Wernicken. And what he did was he took 14-month-olds, and they saw an experimenter either drop a pencil on the ground and then look as if he was reaching for it, or throw the pencil to the ground as if he wanted it on the ground. Now it was on the ground. The baby could get to it. The experimenter couldn't. And the babies had to actually crawl over a bunch of cushions to get to the pencil. Well, if the experimenter dropped the pencil and then looked like he wanted it, the babies would climb all the way across the room to pick up the pencil and give it to him. But if he threw it to the ground so it looked like he didn't want it, they wouldn't. So these very little babies already seem to be able to read, here's what he wants, here's his desire, and if that's what he wants, then I'll help him get it.
Allison Gopnik from UC Berkeley, talking about just some of what the rest of us can learn from the minds of babies.
We've been listening back to some of our favorite Philosophy Talk moments, celebrating our 10th anniversary on the air. John, there's one more aspect of the program we have to talk about. If I were to ask you to describe Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, to somebody who'd never heard the program, what would you tell him?
I would say Ian is where philosophy meets the funny bone. He's got a droll sense of humor. He draws on personal experience and news of the day to take our philosophical theme and make us laugh about it. But, you know, more often than not, at the same time, he also makes us think at a new level. And he does this all, if not always quite in 60 seconds, pretty darn fast.
So without further ado, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it's hard to believe that Philosophy Talk has been in the air for 10 years now. As a matter of fact, it's a little bit impossible to believe. Maybe it's because I've been hanging out with philosophers for the past 10 years. But I find myself questioning the very notion of an anniversary. 10 years on the air, that's not really true, is it? On the air every minute for 10 years, on the air once a week for an hour for 10 years, it's closer to the truth, but that doesn't have the same panache, does it? That would be what, 52 weeks times 10? The 520th anniversary. 520th sounds both more and less impressive than 10th. And that's not really right either. In San Francisco, for instance, the show's on twice a week. So that would make this the 1040th anniversary. Young for a dragon, old for a radio show. And do you count repeats? So this anniversary thing quickly becomes problematic, especially if you believe that time is an illusion, and especially in these times when everybody is on a quest for the authentic. Or at least everybody who's authentic is on a quest. I think that's true. And if it's true, it's either ironic or begs the question. Maybe both. You see what this show has done to me? Despite waves of self-doubt, self-loathing, and severe epistemological shortcomings, I did a Google search and discovered that the gift for a 10th anniversary is traditionally tin or aluminum. So putting in 10 years proves how flexible and durable you can get without being broken. The 10th anniversary jewel, on the other hand, is the diamond. And there's the modern economy right there. Put in your 10 years, the poor get a can of beer, the rich get bling. The poor have to learn how to bend, and the rich are so hard nothing can crush them but Superman's hands. The only people who make money in this scheme of things are lawyers and lobbyists. The rich already have theirs. The poor don't have a prayer of getting it. Of course, philosophers fall somewhere in the middle there. They're not rich, but most of them are employed at an institute of higher learning, so they aren't poor either. So there aren't any homeless Diogenes out there in the agora these days, living in barrels and mouthing off to Alexander the Great. More's the pity. On the other hand, if time is an illusion, there just might be an alternative universe where philosophers make fools of would-be world conquerors on a daily basis. From a barrel purchased at IKEA, which theoretical physicists agree now is a branch in every alternative universe. But alternative universes are nothing but a cold comfort, even if time is an illusion, once those birthdays and anniversaries start to pile up. So I just hope I get a piece of cake out of this deal. Otherwise, what's the point of living? You'd think after 10 years of this program, I'd have an answer to that question. But all I have is piles of empty cold ones and either a pathological fear of eschatology or an eschatological dread of pathology. Either way, it's not good. And I need cake. Pronto. QED. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, iTran, Carola Kreitmar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
10 years on the same job, for the same salary.